From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Harvard Public Policy Professor Bob Putnam, author of the best-selling book Bowling Alone, has released data of a new study which points to some troubling conclusions about the effects of diversity and reveals a definite downside attached to it. Professor Putnam says diversity brings out the turtle in us. We'll find out all about his study and what it portends, especially for public policy, coming up after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Increasing ethnic and racial diversity have been driven in most advanced countries by immigration. There is a kind of sacred, secular, and ideological notion that diversity is essentially good, that there is civic strength in our differences, which makes us stronger. Robert Putnam's study reveals a greater downside. A mammoth academic survey of some 41 U.S. communities that included 30,000 interviews from all over the United States and coincided with the 2000 census. Professor Putnam's work highlights the fact that greater diversity brings with it greater withdrawal from civic engagement and more distrust, which does not necessarily, I need to add, translate as hostility. Immigration and diversity have, Professor Putnam concedes, cultural, fiscal, economic, and developmental benefits, but in the short run, they reduce social solidarity and social capital and foster social isolation. The study also reflects that more ethnically and racially diverse neighborhoods have people with lower confidence in their government and its leaders and in political efficacy. Not to mention the people themselves having general lower self-confidence, though there is also more joining up with marches and a greater involvement in social reform from those living in these more diverse neighborhoods. But there is as well, according to the study, less faith in community action or in collective action and less giving to causes. Also to volunteering. People in more ethnically and racially diverse neighborhoods, Professor Putnam concludes in his research, have fewer friends and confidence and are less happy. Robert Putnam is Peter and Isabel Malkin Professor of Public Policy at Harvard, the author of Bowling Alone, The Collapse and Revival of American Community, and more recently, Better Together, Restoring the American Community, and of Making Democracy Work. He's been a consultant to both Presidents Bush and Clinton, Prime Ministers Blair and Brown, Ireland's Bertie Ahern, and Libya's Muammar al-Qaddafi. E Pluribus Unum, Diversity and Community in the 21st Century, was the 2006 Jonathan Skytte Prize Lecture. It appeared in the June 2007 issue of Scandinavian Political Studies, and it's caused some real stir. And Bob Putnam, good to have you back on Forum. Welcome.
Thanks, Michael. It's good to be back.
I guess let's begin by just...
Michael, can I just make just one brief introductory comment on your summary of my work, which was quite fair as far as it went. You said that I conceded that diversity has advantages. I would say I proclaimed that diversity has advantages. Your listeners might not get from your introduction that basically I'm an advocate of immigration and an advocate of diversity. I think that there are great advantages. I don't concede that. I proclaim it.
I guess that's why, given what you have just proclaimed, you were sort of surprised that there wasn't more anger from your friends and colleagues on the left. You thought they were going to maybe react like they did to Daniel Patrick Moynihan and his paper on the black family a number of years ago.
Yeah, I think my experience is that the left has become somewhat more mature about hearing bad news, and as I say, and as I say in the article at some length, this is my view is that this is not a permanent feature of diverse communities. What on the contrary, what happens, and I make this point at some length in the article that you've described, is that over time and with goodwill, communities become comfortable with diversity. The lines that we initially draw among ourselves get subdued and even erased. And so, over the long run, I'm pretty optimistic that these are problems that we can solve. But I don't think progressives would do ourselves any favors to hide the fact that in the short run, getting comfortable with diversity is not an easy, simple matter.
Well, speaking of hiding, I mean, again, we get back to this notion that people who live in ethnically diverse neighborhoods seem to hunker down and become, you use the word turtle-like.
Yep.
What gives you the confidence and the hope and the belief or faith, whatever it is, that will change over the course of time?
Well, because, first of all, we've done it before in this country. We've been through periods of massive immigration previously in American history. And we've so successfully surmounted the turbulence associated with those periods that we've actually have national amnesia about how complicated it was. 100 years ago, large numbers of Italians and Jews and Czechs and Poles and Irish people and so on came into the U.S., and we kind of now have this impression that, you know, the Jews were teaching the Italians to dance the whore as they came down the gangplanks. But that's crazy. It was really, Gangs of New York was more like the short-run effect of that diversity. But we, as a country, successfully created out of that diversity a unified, not a homogeneous, but a unified country. So successful is that, as I say, we've kind of forgotten that. And even in my lifetime, actually, there's been enormous progress not erasing, but in becoming less uneasy about ethnic and religious differences.
Does this go back, in your article you mentioned the psychologist Golden Alport and his bringing attention to soldiers and the way race at one point was a great divider and then became ameliorated within the military. Are we talking here about what you call contact theory, that is the more contact theory, the theory being that there's more contact, which means ameliorating these problems more?
Yeah, not exactly, no. I mean, the contact theory basically says, you know, if we get together, we can all get along. And just sort of, you know, putting people cheek by jowl with diverse people, our research suggests, isn't adequate. It isn't enough that you just be, you know, put in the same neighborhood or the same classroom or the same office with people who are diverse. You need to work for looking for shared values and shared experiences that cut across lines of diversity. I mean, the U.S. Army actually is one of the great success stories of assimilation and becoming comfortable with diversity. There's quite good research. The average U.S. soldier today has more interracial friendships than the average civilian, you know, holding constant other things in the background. And so there is a great deal of social connection, informal trust and reciprocity and so on. People don't you know, see other people as black or brown or white, but as, you know, it's all army green. But it wasn't always that way. In my memory, there was great racial tension in the U.S. Army and among races, and the Army worked hard to overcome that. So I think that's, and successfully worked hard to overcome it. So I think it is an interesting success story, but it's not a success story in which all you have to do is, you know, put people together in the barracks and they'll all get along.
Another similar success story that you point to, of course, are religious institutions, which have come a long way as well. But I'm interested in going to the heart of your study, which is, again, greater distrust that seems to correlate to greater ethnic and interracial diversity. And, for example, just locally, you say it's better than expected in Silicon Valley, which is quite diverse, but things are not so good over in the East Bay in Oakland. One would look at those kinds of conclusions and assume that it has a lot to do with poverty and crime and with economics, perhaps even more than it does with ethnic or racial diversity.
One of the advantages, Michael, of the fact that this is a very large study, the national sample we have in this survey is about 20 times larger than the average national sample in America. And that means we can carefully match people along many different dimensions and control statistically for the effect of many other variables that might also be relevant. So you're absolutely right that people who live in diverse communities also find themselves, on average, with more poverty around them and with more crime and with more mobility, and all of those things in themselves reduce trust and encourage isolation. But what we tried very carefully in this study to do, I don't want to get too statistical here on you, but what we did try very hard to do is to hold constant all of the other factors that might be relevant and in order to isolate the effects of diversity. And when we do that, it's true that poverty has an effect, and it's true that mobility has an effect and so on, but it is also true that there is a strong, independent, robust effect of diversity leading to what I've called hunkering down.
I'm just struck by the difference, though, between, say, Silicon Valley, which is quite diverse in many ways, and a lot of that has to do with people who work in high tech who are from South Asia and who
sure.
are from different places, let's say, than the people from Oakland. I mean, it's a different ethnic diversity to begin with.
Yeah, it is, and I don't claim that I know exactly the explanation for that. You've already identified two or three things that might be relevant: the where people are coming from, their level of education, the level of affluence and poverty, and so on. All those. I don't want to hold myself out as here as a specialist on the sociology of the East Bay or the South Bay for that matter. But you've correctly said that just holding constant diversity and comparing, those communities to the rest of America, Silicon Valley looks like a relatively high level of social involvement, civic engagement, trust, and so on, given how diverse it is, and even holding constant its diversity, the neighborhood in Oakland that we investigated looked pretty low in all those things. Actually, probably one of the lowest in all of America that we investigated.
Well, we look perhaps at the size and the composition of different cities. You point out in your study, for example, which, by the way, again, appeared in Scandinavian Studies, Los Angeles and San Francisco among the most diverse populations in human history, the interracial trust, the trust of neighbors, much less. And then you compare that, let's say, to Yakima, Washington, or South Dakota, and you can see those obvious kind of chasms and contrasts.
Let's focus on Yakima for a moment, because it's very different from South Dakota. Yakima is a small place, and so are Duluth, Minnesota, or any of these other places up there in the Dakotas. You're right. Those homogeneous places, relatively small places, have relatively high levels of social trust. But Yakima, in terms of size, looks like those places in North Dakota. But in terms of ethnic composition, it's very diverse, unlike those places. Yakima is not all white. On the contrary, Yakima is about, roughly 35% Latino, and then, a smaller fractions that are black and Asian American and then majority white, but only just majority white. So it looks actually much more like the Bay Area or Southern California than it does like South Dakota. And in terms of its level of hunkering, it looks like the Bay Area and Southern California. That is, that Yakima is a very good case that illustrates that diversity, even in a small town, diversity has this effect. And now, because most recent immigration is growing more rapidly in smaller places around America, I think, and we know from just reading the newspapers, that those are places that are having difficulty with this growth of diversity.
Talking with Bob Putnam, who is professor of public policy at Harvard, also the author of the best-selling Bowling Alone and a recent study on diversity, which I guess neocons are rejoicing about, or people on the right are rejoicing about, which can't make you happy, given your proclaimed progressive politics.
I think, this is a study which says we've got a problem, and we can fix it, and some people, for ideological reasons, choose to focus on the first half and to ignore the second half. Just as I think it would be unfortunate if progressives ignored the fact that it is a challenge to get comfortable with diversity. I think it would be a serious problem, and frankly, this is much more evident at the moment. If conservatives ignored the fact that this is a doable task, becoming comfortable with diversity is not some strange, odd thing. We've done it before in this country, and the really bizarre thing is that many of the neocons who are saying we ought to, put up the walls and pull up the drawbridges are themselves descendants of immigrants of only, two or three generations ago, who their ancestors, were implicated in the same kind of hunkering down. So this is a normal process. We've got to worry about it. That's what I'm trying to say. But I also think that the people who ignore that there are some success stories aren't doing the country any favor.
Weren't you also getting some allegations out there in the blogosphere that you try to suppress the results of your study or something along those lines?
Yeah, that was just a complete... I don't know that we want to spend a whole lot of time on this because it's inside baseball, but there was an allegation by a conservative reporter that I sat on these data and didn't report them because they were uncomfortable to a progressive like me. That's flatly false. I issued a press release about the data and this pattern 6 years ago. It was covered, actually. I did an interview with the San Francisco Chronicle and a half dozen other newspapers from, you know, Atlanta and Chicago and all over Boston. So, and it was all covered in the public press, and we released the data instantly. So it's been, anybody's been able to analyze the data for the last 6 or 7 years themselves. And in fact, it has become, this data set is one of the most widely used data sets in all of social science. So the idea that we somehow sat on the data is, or tried to suppress the results is wholly and demonstrably false. You can look up at the web and the San Francisco Chronicle and see me being quoted 6 years ago saying these same things.
I suppose, however, there are those of a more skeptical turn of mind who might say, here's Bob Putnam, a well-known progressive in his politics, who says the challenge in this is finding a doable way of feeling comfortable with diversity. I think you used the phrase creating a new we, looking to the military, looking to religious institutions, earlier waves of immigration. And yet what the study reveals is a great deal of distrust, and distrust sometimes, particularly when you're talking about people's attitudes toward their neighbors, can be not necessarily insurmountable, but can certainly be a terrible barrier to get past.
Well, look, I'm trying to make 2 points here. This study does suggest that diversity in the short run is a serious problem. I don't want to downplay that. I'm trying to make that point that we do need to, liberal intellectuals shouldn't, in their ivory towers, shouldn't deny that for most people, and even for people like us, actually, it's not all that easy to get comfortable with diversity. And that's what our data shows. And I'm not far from trying to deny that. I'm trying to measure it pretty carefully with a lot of statistical accuracy. But on the other hand, I also don't want people to use that to say, and this is an unfixable problem. Can I give you a different example from a different historical era? Because all big social change always entails costs as well as benefits. And almost always the costs come first and the benefits come later. Example, the Industrial Revolution, overall, the effect of the Industrial Revolution on public health is very positive. The average life expectancy of people in countries that have gone through the Industrial Revolution is much longer than the average life expectancy of people who are still living in a backward pre-industrial society. But the short-run effect of the Industrial Revolution in the cities of northern England in the early 19th century was dramatically to cut life expectancy. Life expectancy in the industrial cities was about 10 years less than it had been where people had previously been living in the villages of northern England. Now, if you'd been around then, and what happened was, careful people began noticing that you know, people were dying younger in the cities, and they then did a lot of scientific investigation to try to figure out how did that happen. Turned out that it was dirty water, basically, and how can we fix it? And so they, you know, put in better sewer systems and better public water systems, and over the long run, it was clearly a good idea that we went through the Industrial Revolution, but it also a good idea that we recognized and tried to fix the short-run adjustments associated with the Industrial Revolution. And so all I'm saying in the case of immigration is, in the long run, it's going to be much better for America that we are a more diverse society. But in the short run, there are some adjustment problems, and we shouldn't hide those from ourselves.
Talking with Bob Putnam, he's professor of public policy at Harvard and author of a recent study on diversity. What are the implications of your study, do you think, as far as public policy, Bob?
Well, I think I didn't intend that this should appear in the middle of the national debate about immigration. This is a study that's been on an academic time schedule, so to speak, and it just happened that this study was published within weeks of the national debate about immigration. I do think that our debate about immigration so far has been largely about numbers and walls. How high should the wall be, and how many people do we want? And I don't want to deny that those are important issues, but I think there's another set of issues that successful immigration societies have to master, which have to do with, okay, how do we reweave the fabric of our communities once they've been strained by this increase in immigration and diversity? And part of that has actually little to do with public policy. Partly it's what happens in local groups, in civil society, so to speak, in our own daily lives, what happens, you know, in my university, in your workplace, and neighborhood groups and churches and so on. But I do think that there's an important role also for public policy, partly by emphasizing the symbolism of national unity. For example, 100 years ago when we solved this problem, that's when the Pledge of Allegiance was invented, and it was invented, oddly enough, by progressives. It was socialists who argued for the Pledge of Allegiance because they wanted to say, if you sign up to these things, that all men are created equal and all that, you're just as good an American as somebody who was around, you know, at the time of the Mayflower. But in addition, language training is very important. Most immigrants want to learn English. The vast majority of immigrants want to learn English. Most first-generation immigrants find that difficult. Their kids generally don't, and most second-generation immigrants speak English. That was true of Germans in the 19th century, and it is true of Latinos today. And people sometimes say that Latinos don't want to learn English, but there's no evidence that the pattern is any different for Latinos now than it was for Germans or Italians or whatever 100 years ago. But America provides remarkably little public support for learning language. So rather than trying to beat up on people and say you must learn English or else you can't get a driver's license or whatever, much more productive would be if we provided public support for radically increased English language training. There are huge lines or waiting lists to get into English language training classes around America, and that's something practical that we could do that would not be perceived as punitive, would be perceived as productive.
But you don't necessarily mean bilingual education or moving along that track.
I think that the issue of bilingual education is a really a technical one. How is it easiest to have these kids when they're coming in adjust to learning? And you know, my wife is a primary school teacher, and sometimes when you get lots of kids in a class who don't speak English at all, it's helpful for them to have some help at the beginning. So I don't have any, you know, theological view one way or the other on that. I do think that it's quite important that people who are living in this country learn to speak English. It's one of the ways in which we communicate with one another. It will happen. I don't have any doubts that it will happen, because English language acquisition is almost universally true. I think we could help it along a little bit, should help it along a little bit. But not necessarily by punitive measures, but just by providing more support for English language training.
If you've just joined us, we're having a conversation with Harvard Public Policy Professor Robert Putnam about his study on diversity, and it has become an important conversation, I believe, and you can join the conversation. In fact, we welcome you. You can call us now and raise any questions or comments you have by joining us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786, and that's the number whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Again, it's 866-733-6786, or you can send us an email, and our email address is forum@kqed.org. And we'll continue with your calls and emails when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Robert Putnam, who's professor of public policy at Harvard and author of the best-selling Bowling Alone, which many feel is kind of the Bible on the notion of social capital. Now he's into things like omitted variables and selection biases, and we're talking about really conclusions that he comes to as a result of a massive study that was done in conjunction with the census back in 2000, having to do with diverse and interracial neighborhoods, and the findings having to do essentially with greater distrust and what he calls hunkering down in those neighborhoods, concern about neighbors, and the fact that there's less civic activism, as well as all kinds of other conclusions that suggest real differences as to the downside of diversity. I want to go to our callers, and we've got them lined up here, queued up to talk with you, Bob, but I wanted to ask first, why Scandinavian studies, and How do you get to something as subjective as distrust to begin with? I think many of our listeners are asking.
Scandinavian political studies, because this was, last year I received something called the Scheite Prize, which is sort of the rough equivalent of the Nobel Prize in political science, and that's held in Uppsala, and the lectures that are given there in connection with that prize are always published in the Scandinavian Political Studies Journal. Well, it's hard, of course, to measure something as evanescent as trust. We ask people, how much do you trust? And then we had a whole lot of categories. How much do you trust white people? How much do you trust black people? How much do you trust Asians? How much do you trust Latinos? How much do you trust your neighbors? How much do you trust the, local police, the local government, the local media, shop clerks, and so on? And then we ask a lot of other questions besides just about trust. We, ask how many friends people have and how often they meet their neighbors and how often they have dinner with friends how many public meetings they go to how often they give to charity and what charities and how often they volunteer and when and so on. We ask a ton of questions about people's civic involvement. I suppose the most surprising thing about that was that it wasn't just that in interracial neighborhoods people trusted people of other races less. They also trusted people of their own race less. So whites trust whites less in more diverse settings. Blacks trust blacks less. Asian Americans trust Asian Americans less in more diverse settings. That was a little surprising, and it's what led me to use this metaphor of hunkering down like a turtle.
And we'll hunker down and take some calls here, or hunker up maybe. Liza, hi, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, glad to talk with you guys, and happy to have this topic. Just for a little background, I teach intercultural communications in business and orientation, family orientation, and I'm also expecting my first biracial grandchild. So I feel it's okay for me to talk on this. And what I wanted to suggest is that we should have a concept of positive racism, of celebrating our race, because race is basically...
I wouldn't use the word racism there, though, if I were you.
Well,
positive
well,
racism? I mean, racism carries so many pejorative connotations.
It does, but one of the ways that we can change society is to recapture the words and recapture our voice. My grandchild, I don't know if it'll be a boy or a girl, is going to be half Japanese and half U.S. with a little English and Cherokee thrown in. And I think that it's really important both in my work and in my personal family life to celebrate our differences, to recognize them, to explore them, and to recognize that regardless of whether we have differences or not, is not a matter of whether we are of a different race or a different culture. Everybody has differences. And as we learn to connect with our commonalities and let our differences kind of spin to the outside of the circle, that seemed to be what worked really well in overcoming the mistrust in the workplace, and I think it also works in the family. So I'm really glad the last comments before I got on were about trust. And trust is built with familiarity and with getting to know people.
Well, thank you for those comments. I appreciate hearing from you. I guess just not necessarily to frame this politically, but maybe that's what I'm doing, Bob Putnam. There are certainly a lot of people who look at diversity and without any xenophobia or bigotry in their hearts, look at it from the political perspective. That is to say, they feel that there's a kind of political correctness to the idea of diversity, almost secular ideology or a secular necessity to be diverse, and resent interference with their lives that tries to move in that direction.
There's no doubt that there's... first of all, I appreciate Liza's comment. To some extent, I think Liza and I are probably coming from similar places. Actually, I have three biracial grandchildren because my daughter's married to a Costa Rican, and I've got these three wonderful grandchildren that are helping me to understand what it's like to grow up in America as a biracial kid.
Forgive me, but in your article you mentioned anecdotally the whole problem with a grandchild asking you, "Am I Hispanic?"
Yeah, the story quickly is that my grandchildren grew up in Costa Rica. They moved to Pittsburgh a couple of years ago. My granddaughter went to school at the end of the first Friday, she came back and said to her mom, my daughter, Mommy, what's Hispanic? I'm not Hispanic. People say I'm Hispanic, but I'm not Hispanic. I'm Costa Rican. What? And then she said, is Daddy Hispanic? And my daughter said, yes. And she said, are you Hispanic? And my daughter said, no. And then she said, am I Hispanic? And my daughter said, well, that's a complicated question. And what my daughter, granddaughter was learning was the way we divide up the world in America at the moment. I mean, divide up ourselves, and that's a social construction, and we can change that. I don't mean by I definitely do not mean by my grandchildren sort of losing track of their Costa Rican and Latino cultural heritage. It's important to them. That's one of the things they're bringing to America, is that the richness of that heritage. But, and this is where I guess maybe I do slightly disagree with Liza, I do think we also have to emphasize, at least part of the time, things we have in common with other people, and not limit ourselves to celebrating differences. And I want to use an example, if I can, Michael, because to many liberals, it's going to seem like a somewhat strange example. I'm writing a book now on the changing role of religion in America, and as a part of that, we're doing a lot of research in churches around America, and churches historically have been quite segregated ethnically and religiously, but some kinds of churches in America are actually now very ethnically diverse, especially Catholic parishes, because of the incoming, the arrival of Latinos, but also these large evangelical megachurches, which is, I visited, for example, Lakewood, which is the largest church in America, actually, went to a service there. There were 6,000 people at the service. It was one of their smaller services, held in a big former basketball arena in downtown Houston. And in my pew, or it wasn't a pew because it was a basketball arena, but in my little row there, to my right were sitting a Latino couple, then me, then a blonde, then a Korean couple, and then an African-American couple. And the whole arena was like that. And they were all hugging and, this was a Pentecostal church, so they were, singing and so on. It wasn't actually my style of religion, personally, but it was the most micro-integrated, seriously micro-integrated, large gathering I've ever been in my life. Now, how did that happen? And these people in my row, the Korean couple knew they were Korean, I'm sure the African-Americans knew they were African-American, but for a while, some other identity trumped that ethnic identity. In their case, and in this case, the one I'm talking about, it was this religious identity. And
you know where you also see that? You also see that in professional sports, when a team wins or when a team comes to a championship.
Absolutely. And so my argument, and this is the kind of nuanced disagreement I have with Liza, I agree that we should celebrate my kids' Latino heritage, but I also think that we do need to emphasize, in order to reweave the fabric of our communities, that there are things that there are other identities that aren't these racial ones that are also important and that can, as I say, occasionally trump.
So is that the mistake of some public policy folks, that they want to essentially bring together these differences and emphasize with respect to policy, overemphasize even, some might argue, the differences?
Yeah, that's the aspect of the multicultural agenda that I'm frankly a little uncomfortable with. If all that we do is emphasize our differences, I don't think that's going to, I think that will delay the becoming comfortable with diversity that I think is what should be our broader agenda.
And we go to Winchester, Virginia for our next caller. Katie, good morning.
Good morning. I am in a small rural area, and we have experienced a new immigrant growth in the community. Our elected officials are responding by looking into how can we make this community less welcoming so that they will leave. In a conversation with a Board of Supervisors official, he basically ended up saying, I don't like having to press one for English and two for Spanish. It makes me uncomfortable and I don't like it. How can we work together with people who are at that level of discomfort to help them be more comfortable? Because they're the ones who are making the rules, and if they're that uncomfortable, what can we do?
You have some thoughts, Bob Putnam?
I do. Thanks very much, Katie, for that story, which is quite interesting, and it captures the challenge that I'm talking about in this paper. I think there are several things we need to do. First of all, those of us who are on the, you know, more sympathetic to immigration and diversity, I think have to recognize that many people are not, who are not racist, are nevertheless made uncomfortable by diversity, and this is a thing that we need to work on in a positive spirit rather than just in, rather than just calling people's name, calling people names. I don't mean that you were calling them names, but I mean, I think that's the first thing. Secondly, I think we need to remind people of our own history. For example, this issue about will America lose our basic language identity, precisely that same issue was debated at great length and with lots of concern in St. Louis and Cincinnati and Milwaukee and other cities in central, in the middle part of the United States in the 1880s about German, because most people in Cincinnati and in St. Louis and in Milwaukee and other places there in the 1880s, most of the people in those cities were German speakers, and there were large numbers of German newspapers and so on, and all the minority of people who spoke English said, wait a minute, all these Germans are going to take over. What's happening to America? Well, that was, you know, in retrospect, that was kind of a crazy thing to worry about, because it was largely an American, an English-speaking country, and over the long run, we all did come to speak English. And the fact that people, especially the first generation of people, felt comfortable connecting more in their native language, the language they had learned as kids, German, was, you know, shouldn't have discombobulated everybody else. And I do think we need to work on providing more English language instruction. I don't think we want to become permanently a bilingual society, but I also think that we have to kind of, you know, relax a little bit and simmer down, because this is what it means when you go through one of these periods of immigration. And in the long run, it's terrific. We're way better off because of that German immigration in the 1880s. Not just do we have better beer, but we've got, you know, all that talent that was embodied in those places. And so I partly want to just kind of drain this debate about immigration a little bit from the high pretension that I think there is at the moment.
And I want to thank Katie for her call and go to a few emails here. Here's Claire, who says, the closest place I have experienced real diversity and unity is within 12-step programs such as AA and FA, perhaps like the military. It's because there's a unified sense of purpose, and yet, unlike the military, there is no hierarchy. Here's a listener, Merrick, who says, our diversity enables politicians to play groups off against others compared to Sweden, where homogeneity makes this impossible. As a result, Sweden has important features of democracy we'll never be able to have. And yet one more email from Tommy in Oakland, who says, perhaps the tamping down of civic engagement and national unity is actually a good thing. Perhaps the study is really a prelude to something else, something not based on racial homogeneity. It might be a good thing that the soil gives rise to patriotic zeal and active xenophobia is being turned. Maybe we're looking at a snapshot and being unduly concerned about this social science freeze frame when, in fact, we're in a process of evolving, and the hunkering down is a form of hibernation that will yield something new that is now unknown. Any comments, Robert Putnam?
Well, first of all, the idea of the 12-step program is actually an interesting one. I hadn't thought about that, but it sounds right to me, and I agree that you know, sometimes when I use the Army example, which I think is a relevant one, sometimes when I use that, people think, well, sure, what Putnam says is we want martial law or something, which is crazy. I'm a little, I mean, partly I agree with the third writer, the one who says, you know, this is a phase we're going through and we'll come out to something new. But partly I agree with that. That's what I've been trying to say, actually, that this is a transition we're going to go through.
But you see it's something new that has already been evidenced in, say, previous waves of immigration.
Exactly. And the part of that perspective that I disagree with is that we're going to get on beyond the need for trust. We can outgrow our need for trust. And I don't think that's right. I think societies work better when you can basically trust other people. And when we are involved with our neighbors and when we do, you know, volunteer and contribute things and so on. So I don't think that we ought to just relax and give up and say, well, okay, we've moved into this more self-centered, hunkered era. Let's live with that. I think we need to be working more on enabling people to feel comfortable to get out of their shells and to, you know, connect with other people.
And we're going to connect with more of our callers. Hugh, you're on. Thanks for waiting. Good morning.
I want to thank your guest and the conversation so far. I agree with the celebration of multiracism, such as I have in my own family and some of the other callers have mentioned. That being said, I have two comments. One is regarding economics, and that is that in West Oakland, 35% of the families live below poverty, or live in poverty, and 20% are unemployed. And I think a lot of the root of this is economic. That is, traditionally, poor people who might live in West Oakland, who might be but not exclusively be African American, see a lot of competition for the same low-paying jobs with new immigrants. And the second part is, of my comments are political, which is that for a unabashed moderate, I see both sides of the immigration argument often being disingenuous. On the right, they say, send everybody back, no immigration. And on the left, they say, let everybody in. And I find that both have potential, you know, positive and negative consequences, especially when, on the negative side, when one looks at uncontrolled immigration, how it's going to affect existing working class neighborhoods. So I think we need a hybrid of something in between, which is to take the beneficial parts of immigration and have it be controlled in such a way that it doesn't impact negatively existing working class communities and takes into account their difficulties.
By the way, Hugh, there isn't, hyperbole in what you're saying. Tante Credo, who's become identified as kind of the anti-immigration point man in the Republican Party, has said he wants to send all of the illegal immigrants back from whence they came, probably an impossible task at best. Bob Putnam, hear from you.
Well, Hugh, thanks for those comments. On the second point, the political point, probably we're pretty close. I think the idea we could send everybody, all these people back is well, it won't happen. That's the first thing. And secondly, I think that there is a benefit from immigration. On the other hand, I also think that there are problems with getting the country through this period, and therefore I think we do need to have controls on immigration. But with respect to the first point about the poverty and unemployment, of course you're right that the poverty and unemployment and, in general, poor living conditions in Oakland, for example, and other places around America is part of the reason why people in those areas are hunkered down and suspicious. They got a lot to be suspicious about. But what I was trying to say was that the effects of diversity are true over and above that. You can, in our data, you can see very clearly that even upper-middle-class neighborhoods, as they become diverse, more diverse, people begin to hunker down. And so this is not just, I'm not saying that poverty and crime and so on don't matter. Of course they do. I'm saying that even when you hold those things constant, diversity itself seems to have an independent effect.
And here's one of our listeners just dovetailing on that, Sydney, who writes, unfortunately, people are taught in this country not to trust anyone from another ethnicity or from another religion. For such a melting pot of a country, as someone like Giuliani says, no matter what state you go to, there's still a lot of racism and discrimination. As a black man who has a white wife, I've gotten negative stares walking hand in hand with my wife while walking through the Castro, as well as nasty looks while we've been in downtown Palo Alto. Seeing a black man in an upper middle class or rich area in America is very scary to a lot of people.
You know, I, first of all, of course that's true. I actually, one of my good friends is a black, very distinguished, well-educated black woman who was picked up walking on the street in Palo Alto some years ago. So for being black, so I'm sympathetic to that. On the other hand, I do want to remind us that we've been through other times in my lifetime. Actually, there's been reduction in the degree to which we do categorize people by race and ethnicity. Two very quick anecdotes. First, a closest friend of my wife's and mine is a couple who live in Boston. She comes from Irish. Her parents came from Ireland. His parents came from Italian. They're about our age. When they got married in the 1960s, everybody called it a mixed marriage, even though they were both Catholic. It was mixed because one was Italian and one was Irish. Now that seems like a joke because there's been such dramatic change that we're no longer even aware of those ethnic differences. One of their kids is married to a Protestant, one is married to a Jew, so the notion that two Catholics had a mixed marriage because they were from Italian and Irish background seems now crazy.
That I was struck by that in your article. You alluded to that. I mean, the change has been dramatic, yeah.
And the other example has to do with religion. When I grew up, in a small town in Ohio in the 1950s, and I knew the religion of every person in my high school. Even now, I can't no longer remember people's names, but if you show me the yearbook, I can go through and say Catholic, Baptist, Jewish, Catholic, Methodist, and so on. My kids can't do that at all. Now, you might say, well, you know, Putnam's odd. He collects baseball cards. I mean, he collects religion the way some people collect baseball cards. But actually, all of the kids in my class could do that, and now nobody can. And the reason is that in those years, we basically only married people or even dated people that were in your own religious group. And so you had to know whether someone was Catholic or Protestant or whatever, so you knew whether they were a possible date or, in those years, date. And now nobody, you know, we don't divide up this world that way. There's been much more, there is demonstrably way more religious intermarriage in America, and therefore people don't keep track of other people's religion. It's not that each of us doesn't know our own religious affiliation. It's that we don't slice up the world in that way as much. And that's a change that's occurred just in the last 40 or 50 years.
Yeah, I'm from a bigger town in Ohio, Cleveland, but I have to agree, at least from we're a similar vintage, that your observations hold true in my case as well. Where do you hail from originally in Ohio?
A little town just east of Cleveland, actually, called Port Clinton up on the lake.
Yes,
and
yeah.
The Indians were my baseball team when I grew up, and I delivered the Cleveland Plain Dealer and so on.
Well, Cleveland News was my paper, but also the Indians were my team. And we're going to get some more people involved in this discussion, more of our listeners. Steve, join us. Hi.
Hi there. I'm a social psychologist in Santa Cruz, California, and I've read Dr. Putnam's research in Scandinavian political studies, and I have a couple concerns about how the research is being reported. The first is that while according to the very impressive, very large sample group you've worked with, there's an influence on mistrust in communities caused by greater ethnic diversity, but that influence is very small, something on the order of 4%. And there are other influences that have been touched upon, like poverty, which has twice the influence, and number of years of education, which has three times the influence. So it seems to me like the influence is being exaggerated. My other concern is about contact theory, which has also been touched upon. And contact theory, as it was put forth by Gordon Allport, doesn't suggest that just any kind of interracial contact will result in decreased prejudice. It specifies specific conditions like shared goals and equal status and cooperation between racial groups, like in the church that you described, Dr. Putnam, attending, where it seems like those conditions are in place. So those are my two concerns. It seems like contact theory, which has very robust results, shows a reduction in prejudice, has been underreported, and the influence of diversity has been overestimated.
We'll hear Bob Putnam respond to those two points, Bob.
Thanks very much, Steve. On the effects size, I don't, you know, I suppose we're never going to be able to resolve whether the glass is half full or half empty. It's true that individual level characteristics, like your own education or your own income or your own race, have a more direct effect on people's level of trust or their behavior than the characteristics of your neighbors. That is the aggregate level characteristics, and that's always true. I don't know of any research that shows a higher effect of neighborhood on behavior, on any kind of behavior. Forget about my study, any kind of behavior. It's almost always your own personal characteristics that have the largest effects. But and that's true in this case too. But if you then compare not what's the effect of your income or poverty or race or education, but what's the effect of your neighbor's income or poverty or education or race, the diversity effect is just as large as poverty and way larger than many other things that we thought are important. So I think certainly I've never claimed, would not ever claim, that diversity was the only thing that influenced people's trust. That people, our levels of trust are influenced by a lot of things, including, you know, how we got along with our parents and what we had for breakfast. But no doubt, I think, comparing apples and apples, that is, aggregate level effects to aggregate level effects, it's a statistically and substantively significant factor. On contact theory, this approach is inside baseball. It is true, as Steve said, that some of the people who've talked about contact theory have said it only works under very, very specific conditions where there's shared goals and the other things that Steve talked about. The problem is if you put on enough conditions, then it actually almost never applies. So, and it becomes almost circular if you say, you know, people, if they're put in contact with one another and they share goals and there's no conflict among them, then in fact they'll get along. But that approach is being a tautology. And so I think Steve is right that if you put enough conditions on, there just isn't any difference between the predictions of contact theory and these other theories. But the simple idea, which I think is what most people carry away, which is that if you're around other people, we'll get to know them, we'll you know, be more likely to trust them. I think that simple view is not adequate.
We're getting toward the end of the hour here, Bob Putnam. Can you let people know where they can access online your article?
Sure. Probably the easiest way to get to it, we don't have it actually on our site, but if you go to bowlingalone.com or to bettertogether.org, bowlingalone, all one word, .com, you'll be able to eventually, if you look around there, you'll be able to find the right source.
Well, I'm appreciative of the fact that we had this conversation this morning, and I thank you very much for it. Again, Robert Putnam is professor of public policy at Harvard, author of Bowling Alone, and this recent study that appeared in Scandinavian Political Studies. I want to thank our listeners. We would not be here without you. Thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mall and Kevin Guillory, our production assistants, Tina Lauerberg and Sarah Skickney, our engineer, Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Thanks again for being with us on Forum today. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.